Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there while you're over there. Make sure you checked out all the other things that 1517 is doing. Daily articles, online academies. We publish those books. We got those videos. We do events, everything. Make sure you just, you know, pop around the website. You know, click on some links. You know, check out the stuff. I'm sure there's going to be some stuff there that you will enjoy. Also, if you want to support the work of 1517, which of course includes this podcast, you know, Eric and I do this podcast. There's 20 other podcasts on the podcast network. All that stuff is free. Everything that we do is free. And the reason it's free is because people support, people donate. And you can become one of those people by going to 1517.org or just clicking that little donate link in the show notes. And you can become a supporter and help keep all the stuff free, keep all the stuff going, keep the gospel going out, and we really appreciate those of you who do that, so thank you.
Indeed we do. Thank you.
All right, Eric, we're in an even smaller letter this time around.
Yes, we are in 3 John.
I guess it's not
3 John.
I guess it's not smaller.
It's about the same size. It's broken up at least. I don't know the word count, but it's broken up into a couple more verses than 2 John. But it basically has the same type content.
Yeah.
Which again, it really means that we don't have to go over much background to this letter. It's very similar to 2 John in that it seems to be something that is just this private correspondence between the John, who calls himself the elder in this context instead of the Apostle John, although we think it's probably the same person. The Apostle John is writing just a brief note about some sort of basic things that his reader needs to know. And so we pick it up at verse 1, chapter 1 of John, or 3 John, which, by the way, there's only one chapter in 3 John. So he says, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth." Now, who is this Gaius fella? Well, we don't really know. That name seems to be somewhat common because we know that there was a Gaius that traveled with Paul in some of his missionary journeys. Could this be the same Gaius? Maybe, but probably not. We don't really know. And that's about as much as we can say about him, except that John seems to be quite fond of him because he calls him beloved and then says that he loves him in truth. So this is somebody that John sees as a ministry partner and somebody that he wants to equip through his apostolic advice and apostolic teaching.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you know, you hear names pop up in scripture and you're like, ooh, same guy. I mean, probably not. You know, we got 2 Dans within 1517, you know. If you have names that are common, then, you know, it's hard to make a direct connection between them. And it doesn't really matter for the letter. What you can say is that this is somebody who you assume is a leader in the church that he's writing to, and someone whom John calls beloved and says whom he loves in truth. And this is an interesting thing too, where you have like, oh, John says that whom I love in truth. Is he saying that he loves him in the gospel? He loves him in the truth of God, or is he saying that no, I love you. Like this is someone that he is has deep affection for, and I think it's the latter.
Yeah, it seems to be the case because this isn't the last time that he's going to mention his love for him in particular, for this person.
Yeah.
As verse 2 goes on to say, "Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. For I rejoice greatly when the brothers came and testified to your truth, as indeed you are walking in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth." So we do have maybe some hint to this person's identity, and that is, it seems he is perhaps a disciple of John's, somebody that John has equipped and led up over the years. Maybe he's a member or started off as a member of the congregation who then was elevated to a position of leadership or became an elder. again, we're, you know, just kind of theorizing, and it's not all that important for understanding the content of the letter. But what John does rejoice in here is something that all of us should rejoice in, that this person is walking in the truth that is in accordance with the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so, I mean, here you have John refer to him, you know, as his child. And this is not uncommon in Scripture. Paul does this all the time. Paul will speak of Timothy this way. I think it's fair to assume that this is somebody who John probably led to Christ. This is someone who John preached the gospel to and who believed, and then somebody that he then discipled. And, you know, if you've ever been somebody who was part of someone's conversion, and then, you know, some time goes by, or who knows how much time goes by, but it is a great thing to hear that that person is still in the faith. There is a lot of joy found in that. It's actually really terrible when you find out that someone that you were involved in their conversion, you find out that they're not. That's a real bummer.
And obviously, Dan, with both of us having experience as pastors in our lives, we've experienced both of those things.
Yep.
We've had people that we've loved very much that have ended up over time sort of drifting away from the church and drifting away from the gospel. And yet I've also had the experience of having a long extended break from people that I cared about very much as a pastor that have come back to me and told me that they are still walking in the truth, like Gaius here, that they're going, you know, they're attending a church and they're, you know, doing kind of all the things, serving in a church somewhere, or whatever it is. And it does cause great joy. Like, it genuinely is like a day for rejoicing when I come across that.
Well, I mean, and it makes total sense for John. I mean, you have to think, like, John is a guy that's dedicating his life to the spread of the gospel. And so, of course, like, what greater joy could he have than to hear that those who have believed the gospel are still believing the gospel? This is what he is doing with his life.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And so John continues in verse 5. He says, "Beloved, it is a faithful thing you do in all your efforts for these brothers, strangers as they are." Now, the brothers he's referencing are the brothers that had reported back to John about sort of where Gaius is at in his life and in his faith. He says, "It's a faithful thing you do in all your efforts for these brothers, strangers as they are, who testified to your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. They have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth." And Dan, what is up with this lauding them for accepting nothing from the Gentiles? Like, is that a problem? I mean, you know, we as an organization, 1517 has accepted quite a bit of that Gentile donation.
We accept many things from the Gentiles. I think what you have here is that he's saying, look, it's great that you've accepted these brothers. You don't know them, but you assume that these are sort of missionary types. These are evangelists, and they're going out, and Gaius and his community there, the church there, whatever it is, accepted them, took care of them, and they came back. They told John that, hey, you know, they really treated us well. They accepted us. John was happy to hear that. They're definitely still in the faith. John was happy to hear that. It seems that this letter is going back with them to the same place. And now John is saying, okay, you would do well to send them on a journey in a manner worthy of God. Let's not beat around the bush. He's saying you need to support these guys. Like, they're going to have needs, and you need to meet those needs. So you need to pass that offering plate for these guys as they head out.
That's exactly what he's referencing.
Yes. So they've gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Why is that? Probably because as you're going out and you're spreading this message of the gospel to, not to Jews, but to Gentiles, to the unbelieving world, what you don't want is for them to think that you're doing this for the money, right? That, like, hey, this is some kind of scheme here. Like, you're coming and telling me about the forgiveness of sins, but then you're actually really asking me to, like, open up my wallet. That's what this is about. And so to those who are non-believers, I don't think this is just applies to just the Gentiles, but it's probably the Gentiles that they happen to be ministering to. He's saying they're not asking for donations to support the ministry from the people that they are spreading the gospel to. So, therefore, those of you who already believe the gospel, this falls on you to support them in this work. Don't put that burden on those who don't believe as they try to do this work. Instead, you support them because you already believe. And I think that's what's going on here.
Yeah, and this brings up something that we have talked about before going through previous letters in the New Testament, but if you really sort of read between the lines, you're going to find all sorts of requests like this in Paul's writings, in Peter's writings. I mean, you're going to find all sorts of talk about the need for offerings to be taken on behalf of the church, on behalf of missionaries, on behalf of the apostles. This is a pretty common thing. So from the beginning, I mean, you know, sometimes we can get kind of weird in the church talking about money for that very reason. Like, we don't want people to think it's all about the money. And so we, you know, sort of shrink back from it. But when you look at the New Testament, you're like, no, they weren't shy about it at all.
No. No, I mean
they're like, listen, these people are being sent out. Make sure they're sent out with enough.
Yeah, I mean, he says in verse 8, I mean, therefore we ought to support people like these that we may be fellow workers for the truth. Now, here's the idea that you can dismiss any idea that, like, every single person, I mean, maybe you've heard this, and I know what the better intended version of this is, but, like, everyone's called to be a missionary. Everybody's called to be evangelist, and I get it.
Every member a missionary, bro.
Yeah, I get it. You got some coworkers. You should tell them about Jesus. No problem with that. But that's not your job. That's not, like, what you do. It's not what you've been called to as a vocation. You have whatever it is that God has called you to, and it's just as holy of a vocation as the evangelist or the missionary or whatever. The idea here is that John is saying is, hey, we're going to support these that we may be fellow workers. That the way that you can become a fellow worker in this is by supporting them. The analogy that I like to use is that if there's a person who is trapped at the bottom of a well, you can't send, like, the whole town down there to rescue him. This does not work. What you're going to do is you're going to lower one guy down there, and he's going to do, like, the rescue. He's going to go down into the well. He's going to grab this guy. But you're going to need a lot of people maybe holding that rope. Rope's not going to hold itself. Like, who's going to hold the rope here? And that's what sort of, like, giving to, you know, the church, to giving to missionaries, giving to evangelists. I mean, honestly, even giving to, like, 1517, not everyone is going to do the things that any of those people or, you know, a church or an organization, not everyone's going to do those things, but those things do require support to be able to do those things. And so you become a fellow worker in this message by doing that part of it. And this is what John is encouraging them to do, is saying, hey, we need some people to hold the rope for these guys. I'm not saying that all of you need to leave your families and, like, go and, you know, spread the good news to the Gentiles all over the earth. But you do need to support those who are doing that. And this is your, and in doing so, you are a fellow worker.
Yeah, there really is at least two big overarching parts to any sort of mission work, whether domestic or international. And that is, you need senders, which is to say people that are going to financially support, train, etc. And then you need the people that go.
Yeah. And by the way, you need both
elements have to be there. And
you need,
we
more
fool
senders
ourselves if we think it's, yes, and absolutely. Like, we need, the sending part is just as significant as the going part.
Well, you need more senders than goers, because unless you just have, like, you know, maybe a missionary has, like, one benefactor and that can be fine. But typically you have a group of people doing a little bit to send one person to go do the work, right? So for every person that goes, there's a lot of people behind him supporting him with a little.
That's the way it goes. That's the way my church plant basically was able to function for the years that it did, because we had support coming from all corners of the globe, and usually pretty small increments that added up to enough to support the work we were doing.
Yeah.
So this is just the way it goes always with missions. This is the way it's always gone, as we see in this letter from John.
Yeah.
So he says in verse 9, I have written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first does not acknowledge our authority. Now, that's a pretty clear indictment, Dan.
I don't know who this guy is, but bummer that you showed up in the Bible, dude.
Exactly. What's Diotrephes known for? He likes to put himself first.
Yes. And doesn't
the
acknowledge.
Opposite of what Jesus says to do.
Yeah, this dude is like, and by saying does not acknowledge our authority, you have to assume here that John is talking about the apostolic authority, so the authority of the apostles. So you have this guy who is undermining the apostolic authority of John and presumably other apostles as well.
And it is striking how much the first apostles have to deal with this. You know, infiltrators into the church trying to undermine the authority of the apostles and claim that they're super apostles or whatever. Like, this is so common in the early church. And on the one hand, it seems it may be a bit strange, but then you think about it and you're like, oh, no, this is human.
And you might even be like, oh, come on, John. Oh, John's got a little authority struggle here. Oh, someone questioning your authority, John? Getting kind of upset about that? Well, yeah, he is getting upset about that, not because probably John is on a power trip, but that there is such a thing as apostolic authority. This guy doesn't have it and is going to undermine the message that the church is built on and commissioned to spread. And so, yeah, it is important that those – it's important for us. We still bend the knee to apostolic authority.
100%.
It wasn't any less important then. I mean, so like they actually have apostles saying and doing things. We have the writings of the apostles, and that's what we submit to. And like, if you run into some guy who's like, oh, I don't really care about what John says or Paul says. I have my own ideas. That is a huge problem.
And this is the problem that you even may come up against today, where people will try and make a divide between what the apostles wrote and what Jesus said.
Yeah,
you'll get this all the time, you know, and or you'll hear it from some circles. It's like, well, the apostle Paul was not teaching what Jesus actually taught. And if you hear that view, just know that is opposed to everything that the scriptures actually teach.
Yeah, you know, I love the idea that you could be like, the apostles taught something different than Jesus. I'm like, well, you wouldn't know what Jesus taught without the apostles now, would you? Like, so, like, I don't know if this really works.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, attempts
to sort of reconstruct like that just end up failing.
Yeah, you're like, I was reading the Gospel of John, and Jesus said this, but then John says this thing over here, and I'm like, yeah, well, you know, he wrote both his books, so.
Yeah.
And he knew him, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Now, does it take faith to believe that the apostles actually were inspired by the Holy Spirit to write these things down? Sure. I mean, that's true. But that's what we believe. I mean, that is what we stake. We stake our hope on the fact that the apostles weren't lying, but were in fact inspired by the Holy Spirit, and that the evidence they present to us for the resurrection of Jesus Christ and for his life and death are actually true.
Yeah,
so
well,
we do, that's what it means. We bend the knee to apostolic authority.
Well, because the only reason I know what Jesus said is because of the apostles. I can't just say, like, I believe them in this, that Jesus, that this is what Jesus said and this is what Jesus did, but then not believe them on this other thing because I don't like it.
Yeah, because ultimately, if we're really honest, those kinds of arguments that try to pit the apostles against Jesus almost always are really rooted in, like, I don't like that he forbid me from doing this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just what it comes down to. And so, this discussion here kind of puts that in its proper perspective. And this guy is trying to undermine John. So John says in verse 10, so if I come, I will bring up what he is doing, talking wicked nonsense against us. And not content with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers and also stops those who want to and puts them out of the church. So, dude, this guy has gotten a lot of authority, apparently.
Yeah,
he's got some crew of people following him because he's in charge enough to not allow people to come in.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems that, you know, you have to kind of read into this a little bit. Like, I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about here. Makes it very clear this guy is talking some wicked nonsense. And, you know, that's not a great thing to have. The only thing written about you in the Bible is that you're put yourself first and you talk that wicked nonsense, but he's got that going on. And he's not only is he doing that, like, he's not content to just talk. Now he's also going to do some stuff. So it's not just that it did the words that are coming out of this guy's mouth, but it's the actions that this man is performing. And what is he doing? He refuses to welcome the brothers and also stops those who want to and puts them out of the church. So what does this mean to me? The brothers, I assume, is the same people or similar types of people as the people he was talking about before. So evangelists that are out and about, maybe they're coming to your church to, you know, get, you know, to take up a collection, whatever, who knows what, you know, like they're going to go stop by your church and you're supposed to take care of them. That's probably the thing that John is telling you and the apostles are telling you that you ought to do. He's saying, we're not going to welcome these people, these missionaries, these evangelists into the church. And then not only that, he also is going to say, if you do want to welcome them, I'll throw you out of the church. So he's throwing people out of the church that want to welcome evangelists into the church and probably no doubt take care of them and support them. So this is this is like very contrary to what John just said that you ought to do. This guy doesn't want to do that. Why does he not want to do that? Well, there could be any number of reasons, but the reason that would come to mind first, of course, would be that this man doesn't want to support these people. This man does not want to open up the coffers. He does not want to say, let's cut the check to the missionaries. This guy is not about that. Mm-hmm. And if you are about that, he don't really want you in the church.
Yeah. Yeah, there's got to be some ego involved here too and feeling threatened by anybody coming from the outside. I mean, it seems like this guy has got a little power trip going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, he puts himself first, Eric.
Yes, this is correct. So he says instead, John says, beloved, do not imitate evil, but imitate good. Now, if you hear that phrase, and especially what he says next, whoever does good is from God, whoever does evil has not seen God, then what we're prone to thinking is, okay, this is John talking about just being moral as opposed to immoral. Okay, because that's the way our brains sort of naturally work. Whoever does moral things is good with God, essentially, is one way you could understand this. But I don't think that we can take this verse that way when we read the rest of the context of Scripture, and indeed the rest of the context of this passage.
Right.
Because he's going to go on to say, Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. We also add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. So with that being read in the context, it seems here that the good that John wants imitated are those who receive and accept the apostles' authority.
Yeah. This he's saying that, listen, there's an evil thing that's happening here, and it's this guy's putting himself first, talking that evil nonsense, and questioning all the apostolic authority and not supporting or welcoming those who are doing the work of the gospel. That's evil. Don't imitate that. But instead, imitate good. Whoever does good is from God. Whoever does evil has not seen God. What he's saying is like, listen, the way that this guy is speaking and the way that this guy is acting towards those who are spreading the gospel is not from God. And fair enough, right? I mean, that's not good. So he says, don't imitate that. This is not like some kind of... you need to be a better person so that God will like you in any way. This is just like very practical and obvious where you're just like, hey, when you see someone doing the right thing, imitate that. When you see them doing the wrong thing, don't.
Yeah. Yeah. It really does get as simple as that. And so you can see that this letter is about as practical and to the point as you can get. John is countering apparently a false teacher, somebody who has a power trip, and he wants to sort of shore up Gaius and those that he's writing to
It seems that also that maybe this Demetrius is maybe the person that is going to deliver this letter, and he's telling him like, "Hey, I this guy's got the seal of approval.
I vouch for him.
Yeah, you need and don't let this other dude convince you to not welcome this man."
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is, and that carries a lot of weight, obviously, in the early church when the apostle John himself says, no, this guy's a good guy.
Well,
you can trust him.
It seems like what John is concerned about is that this guy's going to get there and that he's not going to be received, and he doesn't want that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so we come to the conclusion of the letter, and it ends very similar to John's second letter. He says, I had much to write to you, but I would rather not write with pen and ink. Again, just this subtle reminder that we're talking about very different times.
Yeah.
Pen and ink is, you know, who gives a thought about any of that stuff? But back then, it was more of a commodity, and he actually had to be concerned about that. And so he does instead say, I hope to see you soon, and we will talk face to face. So again, you get this sense that these letters are just written as sort of a stopgap. It's like, hey, before I'm on my way, I'm coming to see you. I'm going to deal with some of these issues that you're dealing with the, you know, this guy who wants to talk wicked nonsense and all of that stuff. I'm going to deal with that. But this is all I just want to shore you up right now. I'll deal with that when I get there and whatever time it was.
Well, it seems that he feels like it's necessary to write this part of it because this guy is going to get this Demetrius guy is going to beat him there. And he wants to make sure that you know, Gaius understands this.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't want to have to get there and then be like, oh, you totally rejected my guy that came here. Like, I'm going to say, I need you to know not to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really that simple. I mean, both 2nd and 3rd John have this very simple message, all again going, it sort of fits with what we see John write in other parts in the New Testament, whether his gospel or whether 1 John, like this, it has the same themes. It has the same kind of language. But yet it's very sort of almost laundry list type details here. It's just kind of very matter of fact, nothing too flashy, not a whole lot of doctrinal statement or doctrinal exposition in these letters. This is why they're kind of known as general epistles. You know, they're just talking about generalities, that sort of thing. And so he closes in verse 15 with kind of a standard a goodbye. Peace to you. The friends greet you. Greet the friends each by name.
Yeah.
Dan, I like that last part about greeting each by name, specifically because it's John the Apostle writing this, and yet he knows these people's names.
Yeah, so, you know, you can have this, hey, peace be with you. The friends greet you. Greet the friends. Like, okay, so, like, peace be with you. That's nice. Hey, everyone over here says hi. Make sure you tell everyone over there, hello. Good to go. But he adds this each by name, which, why does he do that? Well, The idea here is that he doesn't want them to say, hey, John said hello in a general way, but wants you to know what John wants these people each to feel is that he cares for each one of them, right? So this same joy that he starts out with talking about, that he has no greater joy than to hear that his children are walking in the truth. He's wanting them to know that he cares about each and every one of them. And that's why he wants their name stated. It's not just like another person. Like, all these people matter.
And not for nothing, if anybody had a good reason not to know these people's names, it would be somebody like the Apostle John.
Yeah.
It would be somebody, I mean, any of these apostles were incredibly busy, had tons of responsibility, were probably overseeing a whole lot of individual congregations. There's probably any number of problems that they're dealing with on any given day. We see that certainly in the life of the Apostle Paul. He talks about it, how many struggles he's constantly dealing with the various churches that he started or helped to equip. And so it'd be totally understandable that eventually the people that are part of these congregations would just be one in a sea of faces.
Yeah.
But John takes the time to know the people, and all that to say, that's a pretty good thing. That's a pretty good thing that we should applaud and that we should seek to do, that people that are served by us, we actually know and we care for if we're in that position of pastor or leader.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge difference between if you knew somebody and you hadn't seen them in a while and you were a part of a group and the whole group knew this person, and then they write a letter to someone, and then that person stands up and it says, hey, Eric says hello. And you're sitting in the group and you're like, okay. That's different than if, you know, you come up to me and you say, Daniel, Eric told me to tell you hello. And then you do that with every person.
End of all of his letters.
Yeah, it's way different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does really give a sort of a sense of the closeness of the original community of disciples, that there was this desire to function as a family. In many ways, they had to, because there was persecution at the door anywhere they went. And so there is a closeness here that you get a hint of with this last sentence in 3 John.
Yeah. And that's it, man. We are out of time. We have completed 3 John. So we will be moving on to a new book next week. We are
And we have 3 left.
3 books left. But we have a plan. Don't worry. I know you're thinking, man, by the end of this year, is there going to be a 30 minutes in the New Testament? What's going to happen?
Yes, there will.
There's so few books left. Well, Eric and I have a plan. It's a good plan. I'm excited about the plan. It took us a while to come up with it. It was sitting there staring us in the face what we should do. And then one day, it was just revealed. And then we just understood clearly what we should do.
The light bulb went off.
Yes.
The revelation took place.
And I'm excited about it. So we got 3 books left. We're going to keep going the way that we have been going. And then we're going to do something a little different in the future. We'll let you know what that is later on when the time comes. But don't think that the podcast will be going anywhere after we get through these last 3 books. It's still going to continue, and it's going to be fun what we're going to do next. Eric, I will see you next week for another book of the New Testament.
Sounds good.